Hello and welcome to our KrausCast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner and I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Kraus Financial. Today's topic is ethical billing strategies and effective engagement letters for FLAS fee agreements, hosted by Kristen Davis, Principal Attorney at Life and Legacy Planning. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint and a few other handouts can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also kindly ask that you complete the post-webinar survey that will appear on your screen at the end of the presentation. As part of the CLE requirements, you will need to enter the CLE code provided during the presentation in order to receive your certificate of attendance. And now let's get to today's presentation. Kristen, I'll turn it over to you.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining me today. I practice in Denver, Colorado, and I have an estate planning firm, and I primarily work on flat fee agreements. And one of the reasons I put this together was I have a lot of colleagues who are having trouble getting paid. They want the convenience and the simplicity of doing a flat fee, but you end up with a client who takes significantly more time than you think when things begin. And I hate when any colleagues are having to be stuck in a position of, you know, investing a lot of time and work and not getting paid. And then you have an unhappy client because you get into a dispute over how much the fee should be, or you just feel like you have to eat that extra time. So this topic is designed around, you know, how to have an effective flat fee so you can get paid what the time you're actually putting into the topic or into the work product. And also to go over the new credit card surcharge fees that have been adopted in most states that allow attorneys to pass on the credit card fee to their clients that they're having to pay. It'll also kind of go into some soft skills, into how to avoid a fee conflict so you and the client can have aligned expectations, you know, from the beginning and understand when a fee might exceed what you've originally agreed to as your flat fee. And then I spend the majority of time on those topics. And kind of at the end of the presentation, I also include some notes on compensation and cost recovery acts that has to do with fiduciaries, which I run into like in my probate practice and trust administration, as well as some legal requirements to be aware of on billing statements, especially if you get into a fee dispute or if the court is going to be reviewing your billing in line with either a probate or trust administration. And so that's going to be the beginning of the overview of our topic. And I will stop periodically to see if anyone has questions on different subjects that we're covering. Mine, I know we probably have a national audience, but I'm based, you know, in Colorado. So a lot of this is based on Colorado law. And we have a lot of similarities. Like, for example, our billing structure is based off the Colorado model rules, which is very similar to the national model rules of professional conduct. But I just want you to know there'll be some differences there. Okay. So to start with, kind of like getting a fee, you know, getting an engagement letter in place with a client, most attorneys know that's a really important step and that is recommended by, let me advance my slides here. So this is me and here we go. So when we're looking at the credit card surcharge fee, which I'll get into in just a sec, but just kind of good billing practices to start with is, you know, we want to get a signed engagement letter as soon as possible. And in our office, we try to get that before we begin any substantial work. I've been in practice about 15 years and I've been on my own for about 12 years. So, you know, I think every time there's a mistake or something goes off track, then we implement a new process to make sure we don't have that happen again. So getting the signed engagement letter is really important, especially if there's a fee dispute and you want to pursue going to, you know, recovering that fee through a legal action. You're going to want the signed engagement letter. It will be almost impossible to be successful without having a signed engagement letter that states what the agreement was between you and the client. And the main reason we want to avoid these conflicts is, you know, it requires like a huge amount of emotional investment to go through a conflict. And also it can be really expensive in having to return fees or if you get stuck in a legal action because a client complains to attorney regulation, which has happened to a couple of my colleagues. They were basically unjustifiably reported because the client was simply unhappy when they pursued the fee. So just how to set this up, make it easier for everyone. All right. So to move on to the credit card surcharge laws, most states have adopted the ability for merchants, and attorneys are a merchant in this case, to pass on the credit card fees to the client. Prior to this, they were considered overhead and not chargeable. And in ours, we were a little bit of a late adopter in Colorado, and our statute is more conservative than most. We are allowed to pass on, and it kind of gives us two options, 2%, it's a flat 2% fee for anyone with a credit card charge, or the actual fee we have to pay to the merchant. And the notice must be visible, pre-purchase, and itemized on any bills. There's no surcharge allowed on any payments of cash, check, debit, or gift cards. And then kind of like it's allowed to be implemented at any point after the law went into effect. And I'm just going to stay here for 1 minute because, and then later in the presentation, we'll see that the actual fees paid by merchants, they vary, but typically they're higher than 2%. So the 2%, you're only collecting like a portion of what you're actually having to pay. Each state will have an office of attorney regulation or a similar office, and typically they provide a trust manual or some guidance on how you can, you know, how billing should be completed with the client and management of a trust account in that state. In Colorado, the Attorney General provided a letter saying that the current law applies very broadly to any sales or lease transaction, and, you know, all buyers get the protections provided under the Uniform Consumer Credit Code, which this law is a part of. Business-to-business transactions are considered part of that code, so they might not be covered as part of this law. If it was easier to see you, and when I'm in person, I typically ask, you know, how many people are using electronic payment methods? And I found at this point, you know, in 2025, most attorneys have adopted some type of service provider to help them with billing. My office uses LawPay, and I'm going to talk about LawPay and Clio. And those, I find, are two of the most common used billing service providers. And so under LawPay, because I'm in a restrictive state where they only allow this 2% surcharge unless you're willing to charge, adjust it to the merchant fee, LawPay won't go above that with their billing software. And I thought I had a picture of the billing software, which might be a little bit lower. And so as part of their menu of services, they provide at the very top, it has like a dollar sign and charge. And in that instance, they will apply this 2% surcharge fee, and they will likely apply in your state whatever the legally statute defined surcharge is allowed. And in some states that I think is higher. So when I spoke to LawPay, I spoke to the representatives. They're all pretty knowledgeable about how the payment features work. If you want to start using them, you know, you can call, and they're very, have a lot of good advice on how to apply it. We ultimately decided to charge closer to what the merchant fee would be. And I'll skip down to Clio payments, because in my conversations with Clio, they adopt a higher surcharge fee nationally, and that's a 2.95% fee. So if you do a payment through Clio Pay and the client uses a credit card, they will simply do this flat fee adjustment to any credit card payments. And when I asked them how to reconcile that, you know, with Colorado, which has a lower flat fee amount by statute, they had contacted, you know, all the credit cards and said there was no credit card charging less than 2.95%. So they knew nationally that would be acceptable to apply. And so my office, we've adopted that. And instead of using the charge fee in LawPay, which has really terrible records, like it doesn't have a good itemization of what clients have been billed and when, we have moved to the quick payment feature, which allows us to simply add in that amount manually. And note that we are going to add in the credit card fee if the client requests to use that, use a credit card instead of debit payment. And then for notice, I put the notice in my engagement letter, and I included a sample engagement letter with kind of some outlined items of what to include. I also include it in every bill and in any email where I'm sending the bill. So we send the bill. I put in that our office provides a bill that does not have the surcharge applied. But if the client wishes to use a credit card, we can increase the fee by that 2.95%. And I have found that very discouraging to most clients who then, I would say about 90% of the clients we work with, elect to simply use the, you know, the e-check or a debit so that they don't have to pay the fee. And just making them really aware of that will increase the chances of being on the same page. Once they know the fee is applied, they're less likely to want to use a credit card. And so if they do request the fee or they request to use a credit card, we have to reissue a new bill that has a separate line item on the invoice. And then both ClioPay and WAPay will be able to allow you to direct assets or payments either to a trust or an operating account for easier management. On ClioPay, we found that the fees did appear to be slightly higher on the e-check, which charges a 1% fee for oral e-check, and that's payable by the law firm, but you can't pass that on to the client, where LawPay has like a $10 limit on any e-checks, and that seemed over time to be balance positive and a better result for us and our clients. The biggest question facing attorneys who want to use credit cards or accept credit cards is, can they apply the surcharge to a trust account? And unfortunately, there just isn't a lot of clear guidance on that at this time. That is something that's still being worked out, I think, because the law is so new. And when speaking with Attorney Regulation Counsel here in Colorado, they have actually not have any cases yet, or at least this is about a few months ago when I spoke to them. And so we're, you know, right now I'm in the middle of kind of doing a national search to see if this has become a problem or if there's been any cases. But because it's so new, there hasn't. And there hasn't been a lot of issued guidance by states on whether or not you can use the surcharge be against trust account payments. I was able to speak with the practicing deputy counsel for Attorney Regulation in Colorado when she was giving a joint CLE with me on this. And she stated that unless it was prohibited by the law, you wouldn't be lacking compliance by applying that charge to a trust account. And in ClioPay, if you look at their website, one of the things they promised to do is to not claw back any money from the trust account, even if a client disputes a charge on their credit card. So that kind of indicates attorneys are using their credit cards for this, or they're accepting credit cards for this. They are using the surcharge fee. And if there is a dispute, then Clio just says, please call us and we'll help you, you know, resolve that fee. So ultimately, you're going to have to check each state law to make sure you're in compliance. Okay, so this is the LawPay picture that I have. And this just kind of shows if you're using LawPay, the very top selection for the, you know, dollar sign charge, that's going to automatically add the fee, but it's very hard to see what bills were sent out. And the only way you can capture what bills were sent to clients is by an email they'll send to the attorney's email. So we use the quick bills, and that has a much better like layout for keeping track of who has been sent what fees and where we're collecting on them. But ultimately, the takeaway from anything regarding the surcharge fee is going to be clear advance notice continually with the client so they're aware that you charge a fee for credit cards. In our practice, we go so far as to please ask them to use an e-check because that has the lowest fees. I've also had complaints from fellow attorneys who will have a client with a Visa debit, but because it's a Visa debit, it might trigger an additional fee to the attorney that cannot be passed on to the client. And we put our notice, again, in the engagement letters, all our invoices and any emails communicating with them. And Lobson will also allow you to add, you know, a manual note that goes out with every bill. And so we include this with every single bill that goes out just to let the client know if they think about using their credit card when they go to pay it, we'll be adding that fee. And sometimes it's not easy to add the fee, but oftentimes the warning is enough. And it does give you, you know, standing to enforce the fee if needed. So on to our flat fee agreement. And I'll just say at this point in time, if anyone has any questions on the surcharge fee, it might be a good time to check in. And I have a question bubble up, but I don't see anyone responding. So I will move on to the flat fee structure. So the biggest challenge with flat fees is, you know, high maintenance clients, and you end up going over what you expect the amount of time to be required for the engagement. I think flat fees work exceptionally well with work that's repeatable and you know exactly how long that work will take. If you have, in my practice, any estate planning matters are all flat fee, and then matters that are related to probate, marital agreement, and trust administration, those are unpredictable. And because of that, we don't do flat fee in those areas. I only do hourly at that time. When working with estate planning, I can estimate almost exactly how long it will take me to complete work required by the client based on our first meeting. And I outline that in my engagement letter. So I included a sample engagement letter. And I would say on page 2 is where I go into, you know, what's included in an average representation. And that I see as being within my control. And it's also kind of letting the client know if it goes beyond that, there will be additional fees charged. So one of the most important things, I think, especially for all in Colorado, we have a lot of independent attorneys, a lot of solo firms. About, I think I heard an estimate, it was almost 45% of estate planning practices are run by small solo firms in my state. And small solo firms seem to struggle more with profitability than the larger firms. A lot of that is making sure we know our value and being able to communicate to that to the client. You know, there's always someone willing to do it for less money, but they're probably going to get a significantly reduced product as to what you're providing. And we kind of restate that, especially in my original meeting with the client. I let them know we have really comprehensive services, and that's why we charge a little bit more than someone who charges less. So I think this is more kind of a mentality state of mind of just knowing your value and making sure you're getting paid for that. In the fee structuring, and what I use as framework and guidance is both case law and also the model rules for professional conduct. Many states have updated those slightly based on, you know, occurrences in their state, and they'll have more specific rules specifically for each state. Under Rule 1.5, there's a requirement for all attorneys to have reasonable fees, and it lays out a number of factors that are going to affect the fee. And it, you know, includes things like your skill level, the uniqueness, is it expedited, you know, what other work are you giving up to take this on? So all of those are kind of considered. And also, I think, like, how, you know, like, yes, you may have a great form, but it took you many years to kind of build up this form that works super well. And so that expertise is allowed to be reflected in your reasonable fee. Under the model rules, the fee and expenses for which the client will be responsible shall be communicated to the client, and preferably in writing. And Colorado actually takes that a little further, and we require the fees to be in writing. And they want any flat fee to define what services are covered, what the timing is, and also, like, what work products earns you specific fees. So in my engagement letter on page 2, I have, and it was actually because of this presentation I'd given once before, I got more specific on breaking down my flat fee structure. Let me see if I can pop up this engagement letter really quickly. Let's see, I thought I had this up. Sorry. Here we go. And so looking at page 2, the flat fee structure here is where I kind of break down what is earned at different milestones in the fee. So the first 20% is going to be due after review of the client's information, the first meeting with the attorney, so you've invested probably like 2 hours at this point in the client, creation of the file, and, identifying any document templates that are to be used by the client. The next 30% is due after the client's information has been added to all of those forms. So, normally you'd have a paralegal help us upload that. But at this point, you're up to 50% of the fee. And then 40% of the fee for a total of 90% is due after the attorney customizes the initial drafts for the client. And in my office, we send those to the client to be reviewed. Then we do a review meeting to go over the drafts. And then we, do a signing. So once the documents are sent to the client, I let them know at this point, 90% is due. So even if we have a client who doesn't make it back to us or, we can't get back in touch with them, and I have a little on that lower, our fee, our work is about 90% due. And so at that point, that's reflective of the fee that we've earned. And then I have the last 10% is broken down into 5% is due after the document review meeting. That typically takes us about an hour with most clients. And 5%, the final 5 is due, after the documents are signed. So this kind of slide just reiterates what we talked about. You want to define, what work is included as part of the flat fee. And going back to the engagement letter. So on the bottom of page 2, and I think this is really important to let the clients know, how much the average amount of time takes on each client. And that's what you're basing the fee on. And in order for them to get the benefit of this flat fee, they're expected to stay within the bounds of that average time. And in my office, we define that as 1 hour for the initial meeting and the time required to draft the document, 1 hour for the review meeting to discuss the documents, 1 hour for related revisions, and 1 hour for the final meeting to sign the documents. Oftentimes, you'll have a client who, where we got off track and the times we, I'd say in about 20% of our engagements, we have something come up that gets us off track. And that can be because the client has changed their mind when they review the documents regarding who they want to serve in different roles. Or, there's something in the documents you've produced that is different from what the initial meeting contemplated. And if that, depending on how big those changes are, you can say, I know this is going to take me longer than an hour to complete these revisions. And I know we're going to be probably in excess of what we agreed to in the original meeting. Obviously, if you make a mistake and there's an error in the document that goes off track because of something that you didn't line up correctly for the meeting, I never charge for that. That I consider completely my fault. I fix that. But if the client's changing things, or like in my area of practice, they might say, oh, I need another trust, or in a business contract, there might be like some small matter they didn't think about that they now want to add in. That's well within your rights to say, because this goes beyond the scope of our original engagement, I estimate it's going to take me this much time to complete that work, and that's done at my normal hourly rate. I also just add in that if there's significant revisions, multiple meetings, telephone conference, sometimes I'll have someone who meets with me and then will want to do another meeting with their financial planner. They want their financial planner involved, and that's totally fine, but that is not included in the flat fee. Or if they tell me that upfront, I might charge more upfront to make sure it's worth my time. If you have a client you know is going to be more time consuming, they have a lot more questions, you're well within your rights to go above and beyond your normal flat fee to accommodate that client. Another thing I kind of put in here is that, and I have this in another letter to the client, just said like, I want the work product to match what you want, but it's important for us to be compensated for any time, that goes over. You also want to lay out what your normal fees are going to be, what the hourly rates of different people in your firm are. So depending on what attorney is working on the matter or if it's paralegal work, they know what to expect if they're going to be over that flat fee. My flat fee does not include retitling of beneficiary designation. Another area where attorneys get into a lot of lost time or time that's not being compensated is the client comes back and they say, thank you for this great plan. I now need help updating all of my beneficiary designations on my retirement account or my insurance account or my insurance policies. And we are happy to complete that work for them. And we want to emphasize, especially for any malpractice issues, how important that work is. But that's outside the scope of the flat fee because it's unpredictable. And then the rest of this is, you know, just any excessive fees. If a client cancels last minute, you know, let them know you've done work preparing for it. I work virtually. And so I have an office out, you know, I work out of my house and then I have an office where I meet clients. So if I have to go to the office and they don't show up, I'm going to charge them a fee. For clients who lose touch with you and they, you know, don't follow up with you and you've been following up with them for a few months, there's also kind of an extra fee if they do want to get back in the system and begin, you know, the work again. So I think the key to having a happy client is going to be avoiding any big surprises, keeping them informed of what's going on through the process and where you think you're beginning to go off track. You know, your client's not going to remember everything you have in your engagement letter, and certainly not as well as you are. And they might assume they're well within the engagement letter and be totally surprised if you let them know you had to go over and now they owe an extra $800. So if you just let them know ahead of time, that will really help everybody stay on track. As far as collecting retainer payments, you know, some people do 100% upfront. That makes it really easy to collect your fee. And then, you know, you can return any unused portion. I like to do 50% upfront, 50% upon delivery, or when the client signs the documents is typically when I collect that final payment. It's always important to remember, you know, fees are not earned until the work is performed. So, you know, if the client shortly after you sign up together decides to go with a different attorney, they want their feedback, it's important to have that, you know, engagement letter that's marking out exactly what the work was done. So you can determine where you are in the percentage of the fee that was earned. You know, and the signed engagement letter is what everyone's going to look at if there's any dispute. If it's a verbal commitment, it's going to be a lot harder and it's likely to be unenforceable at that point. And then I think once you get into a point where you and the client are getting off track, you know, sending out reminders, we typically send out a package that says, these are documents for your review. It's time to set up your review meeting. You don't hear back from the client. I typically send 3 reminders, usually 1 a month, knowing clients could be busy, there's stuff going on. And if I don't hear from them at that point in time, we usually send a note saying, if you aren't able to get back in touch with us, you know, the remainder of your bill is now due and we would like to collect payment for that work. However, the most important things to us in our office is getting, you know, is getting your plan completed. That's what you signed up with us for. That's what we want to do for you. But if you don't get back in touch with us, you do have this outstanding bill. And that bill is now due and likely to go to collections if you don't follow up with us. And I'll just go back to that engagement letter one more time. You know, we began including a lack of communication provision because we did have maybe like 10% of our clients to 20%. They do just kind of, they struggle to get back in touch. Our collection rate's very high, and I'm amazed at how many people do eventually get back in touch with us. It's normally after there's an emergency, someone in their family died. They realize the importance. If they're parents, every time they go on a trip, they're going to think about, oh my gosh, I have to get this in place. And I always say, just but let's not work on it the week before the trip. We don't have enough time. But, you know, they're more willing to kind of pay these fees when they have an exigent circumstance that helps them understand the value in getting it completed. And then nothing else probably in here. So let's switch back over to our slides. And deciding whether to enforce an unpaid agreement, you know, at some point you have a client. Before I get to this, I'm just going to mention one other thing, which is, you know, clients want the benefit of the bargain they have made with you. They want to stick with that flat fee. They typically will be unhappy to outrageously angry, depending on who they are, if you suggest that you're going over. So what I have found to be really helpful is to keep them in line, you know, with what the fee has or what the agreement says. So if they are sending you multiple emails with a lot of small questions, I know how much we all love getting 10 emails in a day from one client that all have one question in them. I often suggest to them, you know, if I'm responsible for the time to respond to each of these emails, it's likely to put us over the flat fee arrangement. However, if you consolidate all of your questions into, you know, one time, we can have a meeting, we can discuss them at the review meeting, or even if you want to, you know, put them into one email and send them to me at once ahead of the review meeting, then we can review those together at that time. So that's just kind of a way to help everyone stay on track with the expectations. Our biggest goal throughout each engagement is typically we want to get paid. We don't want to have bad reviews. And we want to have a client that completes their documents. You know, you're more likely to have happy clients who are willing to refer you if you can get the documents completed. And even clients have said to me, thank you for helping me get this done, because it was, you know, maybe they were intimidated by the subject, or every time they think about it, they want to avoid it because it's scary for them. And it is, certain legal processes are really scary to people. And so, you know, you're kind of dealing with an emotional component as well as the practical side of just getting the work completed. When it comes to enforcing an unpaid fee, many attorneys are reluctant to go into enforcement proceedings over a modest fee. And that's primarily because, you know, if you get into a legal conflict, you are going to have to report that on your malpractice insurance, which is likely to drive your rates up. And clients may at that point decide to come back and let you know exactly why they didn't pay it. They weren't happy with your work product. They felt you missed a deadline. They didn't have timely communication. You know, something we discussed when I worked in restaurants for a while, and we always wanted to give the customer a sense of movement. So if we were behind on a project or behind on delivering anything, you want to just let them know, hey, I know this is due. You know, something came up for me. I had a kind emergency. I had a personal family matter, but something pulled me off track. I haven't forgot about you. And I, you know, you're still on the top of my priority list, and I'll be getting out your documents as soon as possible. And clients who are well-informed tend to be a lot happier because they know what to expect. And when they know what to expect, they're not as frustrated with where they are or feeling lost or feeling forgotten. You know, and part of that is thanking clients and, you know, I'd say retaining goodwill or building goodwill. But like, we take every opportunity to thank the clients. When we get their payment and we get a signed engagement letter, we try to get them a notice right away, letting them know it's been received and we'll be in touch with their documents, you know. I think our response is something like, we will be in touch with your documents in the near future. We don't typically use hard deadlines because things come up in my experience, creating a lot of hard deadlines, which some people works well for them. I prefer to have what I call a rolling deadline. And that means like, you know, once we receive a signed engagement letter, it typically takes us 4 to 6 weeks to provide the documents. I put this all in an introduction to my clients, and I say after that, you know, about 2 weeks later, we're going to try to get you signed up for a review meeting so you have time to review everything. And then we usually can complete documents and be ready for signing within a week after that. And the appreciation will go a long way to making clients, you know, feel appreciated and value your services. Any unearned fees do have to be returned to the client, so that is something to be aware of. And this might be a good point to just see if anyone has questions about engagement letters or has had any specific problems that have been difficult for them to resolve. based on the structure they're using. Okay, and I don't see anything coming up, so I will continue. And a lot of this I've kind of gone over before, but just, you know, helping clients stay within the agreement, keeping them informed of the agreement, keeping them informed of your expectations to get everyone aligned. Some of you probably work with fiduciary fees, compensation, and cost and recovery act. And that is going to extend to personal representatives, trustees, guardians, and conservators. In Colorado, we have a specific statute, and I'm sure most of you do, that goes into what exactly is governed under the compensation. We have a fairly quick turnaround time in that those we want to get documented and submitted within 35 days. So that's important to ensure that your client will get paid if they're acting as a fiduciary. The court set the standards on what they expect, and they determine as reasonable and what are reasonable factors. Some of that includes, you know, what is the speciality on the work that's being billed for? What is the client giving up in their normal practice or profession in order to serve as a fiduciary? How much time it requires of the client? How much skill level? An important thing to keep in mind is if the client typically receives maybe, you know, $80 an hour at their normal job, but they could hire someone that does cleaning fees for maybe $30 an hour, the court would expect them to hire someone who is better suited to the job than completing the work at a higher rate. But everyone is entitled to reasonable compensation, and I think that's a pretty standard law across the board for anyone completing this type of work, is everyone is entitled to reasonable compensation. When working with fiduciaries who are beginning a matter, especially if they're inexperienced in something like this, I always encourage them to do detailed time tracking. And that might be kept either on a daily or weekly basis. In Colorado, you're only entitled to compensation that's been itemized. So they expect, just like the attorney's time, to be itemized by the client regarding the type of work, how much time they spent on it. I always give clients a sample timesheet, so it's easy for them to begin including them when they do the work. And oftentimes, if you're representing someone as a fiduciary, they will say, I don't need to be paid for this. I just want to help out, you know, my family. I'm willing to do this work without charge. And then about 2 months in, and they are spending significantly more time on this than they ever thought possible. They didn't realize Wells Fargo would want them to come in, you know, 3 or 4 times to answer one question because they didn't have the right documentation. They begin to think, this is a lot harder than I originally thought it would be, and I would like to get paid. And in those cases, now they've lost kind of the 2 months if they haven't been tracking it. So I just say, even if you don't think you want to get paid, you know, keep track of your time, and that way we can add it back in if necessary at the end. And you'll also, as the attorney, be able to guide them and say, hey, I know you have like 5 beneficiaries, and I can already tell there's a lot of unique assets in this probate that you'll need to deal with, or, you know, whenever it relates to, you're going to likely want to be paid. It's going to take a long time. The other thing that's helping whoever you're working with, you know, delegate their responsibilities. Is there someone that could help them get the work done? Or could a paralegal in your office get the work done for them easier and more efficiently? And are they okay with paying a fee for that? Like, I also work with elder clients. So, you know, getting a care manager in place or getting someone they can rely on to help with the care process alleviates a ton of stress on the family. And my goal, I think, is always to help clients be less stressed, so they're happier, and that's probably the best added value I provide to many of my clients. Something to be aware of on billing is billing statements are not privileged, and that can be a surprise to certain people. If you're not working with fiduciaries and you're not having a court review some of those billing statements, then this might come up if there's a conflict. And for the first time, you know, especially maybe in a business matter where you have clients with opposing views, there might be a conflict between the two of them, or certain members of a business aren't happy with the representation. They're going to want to have those bills submitted so they can review the reasonableness of your fees. This is especially helpful to know when you're doing billable time, so you can be aware and be careful in how you are communicating your fees. There can be choices you make when devising a bill that would either disclose specific information or perhaps be in more general terms, but be able to accurately describe, you know, exactly the work you're doing. So I think just assuming they're going to get reviewed by an adverse party when you're drafting them will help reduce how much time you have to invest later on if a conflict arises. You can, of course, redact any privileged information, but that can get really time consuming. And you're not going to want to be in a position, especially as a small firm attorney, of having to be responsible for this unpaid work. And, you know, the less, more we can avoid unpaid work, usually the happier we are. If disclosure is required, right, you have to review, and just kind of being aware of the language. Another important thing to keep in mind is for collecting fees on billable matters is you are wanting to be careful to avoid block billing. So my office also handles probates, those we have to handle hourly, as well as marital agreements. And on those, we are careful to break down how much time every specific task is taking. And that could even include potentially working on different areas of an agreement, like a marital agreement. You might spend, you know, 4 hours in one day completing the work for that, but it's not going to, you know, if you just put in 4 hours, it's hard to tell what the work was. And I am going to just pull up an example of this in the outline, and I apologize, I have to open up one more window here. Let's see, is this the wrong one? Hang on 1 second. Okay, now this is going to be at the very end. So in this section on block billing, this is just going to look like what we want it to look like for the client, where it's going to break out multiple tasks that we're doing and exactly how long each one of those tasks is going to take. So kind of like each, like it's pretty easy on a probate because the situation in this particular example is very varied. But even if you're working on a marital agreement, it might be breaking down, you know, creating provisions related to payment after death, creating provisions related to a divorce, which would be different. And just letting the client know how much you were working on each of those will also show them, you know, the added value to what you're completing on the engagement. So, you know, when we think about kind of having a successful engagement, we want to work on making sure both the client and the attorney are aligned in their practice expectations and be able to identify where you're going to receive a higher bill for different work. Another area might be like, you know, if they require immediate turnaround, you can let them know, I'm going to have to work, you know, evenings and weekends to get this done because of the existing obligations I have to other clients, to let them know why their fee might be higher if they need something done immediately. And just as important to defining how the engagement will be successful might be keeping an eye out for red flags. So if you know right from the beginning that there's something off between you and the client when you're having your first meeting, you can let them know that, you know, maybe this isn't going to be the right fit for them and you're going to have to work closely together. So I think just as important as having language that helps you align to move forward, coming up with language you feel comfortable with to help you get out of an engagement that's not going to be successful is just as important. we've created a template of what we consider a compassionate no. In my, if I have a receptionist that's assisting us with answering phone calls, that's something that, right, from like kind of the, everyone in our office has to know how to give a compassionate no. And on Google reviews, you know, the only two bad reviews I got were from clients that said my office refused to take their case. And we refused to take their case probably because it just wasn't going to be a good fit for us. And when you do accept a client isn't a good fit, it's typically going to lead you down the path of unhappiness. And I think there's a saying, if, you know, 80% of the work, I should have written this down before I got in, but it's something, a better way to say it would be like, you know, like 10 to 20% of your clients can sometimes create the most work for you. And so if from the beginning you learn to identify how it might get off track with them, and maybe as opposed to like, maybe they're not willing to listen to you, maybe they don't value your skills, maybe they found you on Google and they're really just looking for price. So I think identifying where you are in your profession as far as what your goals are, what your ideal client is, it's easy to say, you know, someone that is going only for price and the cheapest price isn't going to be a great client for us. Someone, for example, in my practice, we provide a lot of comprehensive planning. We are going to talk about, you know, how this plan will affect you in every way. So not just the plan itself, but how we should line up your beneficiary designations. And even though we charge hourly to help implement them, we will advise the client on how important it is to make sure those are aligned. And we continue to put that throughout the engagement process. We do it in the engagement, you know, in the introduction letter, in our explanation letter, in the closing letter. So the client can't come back and say, well, I didn't know that, but a lower priced firm isn't going to offer that. And if that's a deal breaker for the client and they want that lower price or they want a really simple document, I think knowing at your core and defining where you excel the most and how you help the clients the most, it's easier to understand when it's not going to be the right fit for you and to provide them with a compassionate no. One of our probably most spoken statements to people when we know right from the introduction call that it's not going to be a good fit is just to let them know, you know, unfortunately, we have a number of existing obligations and we don't think we're going to be a good fit for them because of timing or how much work we have at the moment, so that they understand why we're not taking them on as a client. In every state is going to have professional rules of conduct and case law that will provide a strong framework for guiding, you know, how to craft your engagement letter, how to respond to your clients to avoid potential conflict, or if there is a conflict, to make sure that you have well-documented evidence that you did not fall below the standards expected of you as the attorney. You know, clear communication and detailed communication throughout the process, and then documenting your processes and remedies will also help, kind of like if there's a conflict, but also just help with the client. Like every time we send an email to a client, I make sure we've included all of the previous emails. So I can show them, you've communicated, you know, we've sent these drafts out to you three times at these three times listed below, and we haven't heard from you. It just helps, I think, give you a more justifiable case when you have a complaint with the client to say, here's all the work we've put in. And, you know, at this point, we do need to be paid. And this is why we're asking for additional payment for any reason. And I think that concludes most of what I needed to let you know today. And our CLE code is going to be KSS2025. And again, just a cute little meme saying, like, you know, when the client is price sensitive and that's what they want, that might be exactly what they get as a product they're not that happy with. So I will open it up and see if there's any questions that anyone has on this. And if there's no questions, I can turn it back over to Katie to conclude our time.
Sounds good. Again, put this code into the survey that'll pop up on your guys' screens at the very, once you exit out of the webinar. You do need to put this code into that survey in order to get your certificate of attendance. Thank you again, Kristen, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.